lodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune.
These were documents that were produced in court.
Absolutely.
And those documents were showing Kroll, as a private company, was directing counter-terrorism police on the ground. How much of the detail of this did the BBC get?
Nothing, they didn't touch it at all. They've seen it all.
Nothing at all. There's nowhere we can go to where a BBC source or programme shows that £1 million worth of state money was putting 25.
And that a private security company was directing counter-terrorism as officers.
So the BBC didn't report that.
No,
the BBC did come up with a very detailed programme of jihad.
You're listening to episode 672 of Unwelcome Guests, Mainstream or Extreme. 77, Islamophobia and the commercially controlled media as establishment tools. I'm Robin Upton, and the two clips we just heard, featuring Ian Puddick and Brian Gerrish, are an illustration of what is to come in this show. We're looking at Islamophobia and how it serves the purposes of various key players, such as the media, but also the counter-terrorism industry, and, as we shall hear later on in the show, the wider purpose of keeping a people divided as a distraction and as a cover for bringing in a police state. The title this week stems from my exasperation that a lot of right-thinking people still seem to talk about the mainstream media as if the commercially controlled media deserves some kind of privilege. The argument that, oh, the media report it, so they must just be reporting what people want, never held a great deal of sway for me, because we know there's things like D-notices and governments do censor news stories, but in these ages of media consolidation, a small number of people decide, I think we need to publicise something about a chemical weapons attack on Syria, then, hey presto, stories about it can pop up like magic. And of course, unless we trust the integrity of the people in the secret services, unless we trust the integrity of arms dealers and other clandestine operatives, then a real chemical weapons attack could occur if a certain amount of money is paid. And in the business environment, well, ethics and laws don't enter into it as much as cold calculations. This is a familiar topic on the show, so I won't preach to the converted, but let's get started with an interview. This is Tony Gosling interviewing
Professor David Miller from Bath University. He's a professor of sociology. First of all, tell us a little bit about sociology as a discipline. What are you supposed to be looking at as a sociologist?
Well, sociologists like to say that they are involved in the queen of social sciences, that is the social science which examines how everything fits together. So it's not just politics, not just geography, not just business or economics, it's how all of that fits together, how the society operates as a whole. And I guess I believe that as well.
So what attracted you to the study of how it all fits together? Is it just because even just one of those disciplines on its own isn't quite enough?
Well, I think that's true, but I think what attracted me was more that when I first came to sociology, I realised that all the things I thought about the world weren't actually mad, that actually other people thought those things too, and that if you studied them enough, you could actually learn more about that and learn how the whole world worked together and how, in fact, much of the disastrous nature of our society had come about. So I came to sociology as a revelation, that to realise that I wasn't actually mad.
Okay, so the disaster, you're talking about the disastrous parts of our society. Is that what you're looking at? I mean, do you think, I mean, would sociologists as a whole think of society as a bit of a disaster? Or is it just now?
I think sociologists differ. I think that one can talk about the way in which the disaster of the world influences sociology to become a bit more disastrous. But I think, for me, sociology is about understanding how the world is, and therefore working out how it could be made better. And when I say disastrous, I mean, you know, we live in a world of massive inequality in this country and between nations, which is heading towards an environmental catastrophe. Everyone agrees with that, apart from people who are in the pay of the oil industry. And really, there is, doesn't seem to be any appetite in any political regime in this country or in other countries to actually sort that out. Everyone kind of knows in this country now what the problems are with the world. Most of the institutions in our country are well known to be corrupt, but there's really nothing in terms of any will to try and do something about that, to try and fix the problems that there are in society.
What about the universities themselves are rather elite institutions, David, aren't you? How do you manage to fit it? Do you ever find that people at the universities are saying, well, this man, Mr. Miller, is making a bit of a stir here?
Well, that's true. That does happen. But, I mean, I think the thing about universities, whatever the problems that they have, and in particular the rule of money in universities, which has increasingly been the case in the last 20 years, that they do still form some kind of protected space for people to pursue knowledge, and I think that's worth defending.
One of the things that you, I know, helped begin, I think it was when you were up at Strathclyde University, was this organisation Spin Watch. What made you think that that was something that needed doing?
Well, I guess this was started in 2004, and in the period running up to that, I suppose two things made me feel about that. One was the evidence that corporate power was increasing, that corporations were able to run society in a way which they hadn't been able to do before, and as we'd seen at the time, the rise of global governance institutions like the World Trade Organization, and big protests against that in 1999 in Seattle and then throughout the world. And the second thing which made me think that Spin Watch was important was the run-up to the Iraq War, after 9/11, the huge onslaught of propaganda from the US and UK governments and others to try and convince us of things about the world which weren't true, such as that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and similar the products of the fevered imaginings of propagandists. So I think that for both of those reasons, for corporate power and the ability of corporations to run societies in the way that they want to, and because governments were able to lie and get away with it, that was why we thought that it was important for us to investigate that those kinds of processes and try and share the knowledge that we found with as many people as possible.
The fevered imaginations of propagandists. Now, that almost links back to something you were saying at the start, David, about, you know, you realised you weren't the only one that was crazy. And I wonder if you think it's true to say that some of the narrative that we're given through the mainstream press, for example, in the run-up to the Iraq War, is actually itself somehow sort of mad, and that it's... you know, maybe you're not the only one that thinks like that, and that there is a sane way of analysing things, which is almost become unacceptable in the mainstream press, and it's certainly the sort of more acceptable, I don't know if you could call it that, but in the more general dialogues that we have with each other.
Well, I mean, I think to try and tell the truth in the contemporary period is difficult, because there are many institutions which are set up to mislead the public, and actually also mislead the political elite into thinking that X is true or Y is true. So, yes, it's difficult to try and find out the truth and to spread the truth, but it is possible.
I mean, these lies, I mean, obviously there is somehow money or some kind of financial impetus behind it. But what's the wider effect that has on society? I wonder if maybe it has quite a traumatic effect when people are trying to make sense of the world around them, and they're finding that the things that the jigsaw pieces, if you want, that they're using to put that together are themselves actually never going to help them. And they're almost fighting a losing battle to make sense of the world.
Well, I think you have to look carefully at what the lies are for and who the lies are told to. And I think it's true that in the traditional sense of propaganda, lies are intended to mislead the public. And I think that they do sometimes do that. So I think your point about people finding it very difficult to find out how the world operates anymore and to tell the difference between truth and lies, that is very difficult for people in the world, and it can be very disorientating. And I think that's part of the explanation for the rise of the far right in its country, but that's kind of another question. But I think the other important element we've got to understand about propaganda is not just to convince us, it's to convince elements of the elite. It's to solidify elements of the elite into shared understandings of the world and shared understandings of what's important to be done in the world. And that really doesn't... In that process, it doesn't really matter what we think. So even if we don't believe anything that they say, that really is of no consequence to them whatsoever. It only matters to them if we can interfere in their plans. So I think, yes, people are disoriented. Yes, people do sometimes believe the lies. But overwhelmingly, in relation to Iraq, people didn't believe the lies in Iraq, in this country. Even in America, there was quite a lot of scepticism in the population about Iraq. But it didn't require the population to believe the lies in order for us to go to war. And I think that that's one the very most important point that shows is that we don't live in a democracy. The notion that popular opinion matters at all to the people in charge is something from a bygone era when there was such a thing as social democracy, however limited that was.
It almost sounds as if the mass population are kind of bystanders on a one-way communication between powerful people that just want the decision makers to think in a particular way, and we're kind of bystanders on that theatre.
Largely, we are in most circumstances. There are ways in which ordinary people can influence events. They can vote for parties that are largely the same these days, or they can go out and demonstrate and organise, and that's the only way that really that effective popular action is going to make any difference. But the level of formal politics is not really somewhere where we can intervene very, very effectively, because it's a system which is increasingly devoid of popular inputs, and it's a kind of closed system which we can look at and we can understand if we want, but we can't really take part in.
One of the interesting aspects of SpinWatch, is it spinwatch.org?
Yes.
Is the fact that you when you started that, you also incorporated into it a whole sort of area of investigation. So you weren't prepared to simply just sort of cut and paste information. You would target specific areas of society and go out and find out more about it. Now, how does that all work?
Well, I mean... I don't want to make it sound complicated, because it's really not complicated, but it does require you to think through a lot of issues and to find ways of getting information. But most of the information that we get is not information that we get from secret sources or from whistleblowers, although sometimes that does happen. But it's information that we get from largely from the public record or by using legislation, such as the Freedom of Information legislation or the Environmental Information Regulations, which many people, I guess, won't have heard of, or other things like the Data Protection Act. There are many ways for us to find out information, which we can find out as citizens, or as journalists can find them out. So there is a lot of data out there. If you want to investigate an organisation or a set of individuals involved in a think tank or a lobby group, then it's perfectly possible to do that. There are lots of obstacles in your way, but you can find things out on the public record. And the trick is in putting together the scraps of information which are available in the public sphere and putting them together to give a new picture. And that's the kind of thing which we specialised in.
Okay, so can you give us a couple of examples of investigations that SpinWatch has done over the last few years that you've found particularly enriching, or something that maybe surprising?
Well, I mean, I suppose we have used the Freedom of Information legislation a lot, and that's allowed us to reveal information about lobbyists' access to government, about the fact that, for example, we took one Freedom of Information request about the Association of Ex-MPs, which took us 3 years to get an answer to, by which time several of the MPs had died. And we asked for the names of the people who were members of the Association of Ex-MPs and who therefore had parliamentary passes. And as a result, when we finally got the information, we were able to find out that many of them were actually lobbyists. So this is a secret way for lobbyists to get passes to the House of Commons in order for them to casually bump into the minister or the MP to have a word with them to ply their trade. So that kind of investigation it's sometimes time consuming. This one took 3 years. Sometimes it comes up with nothing, but quite regularly, you know, you can find out information about corporate people meeting with ministers or information which they're sharing internally in Whitehall, which is not being shared externally. And that kind of thing, investigation, while time consuming, is not difficult to do. And so those kinds of activities are really quite important, I think. But then the other way to do things is not even to use legislation, but to check out an organisation by checking out its presence online. So for a couple of examples, we looked at a number of examples of science-like organisations calling themselves institutes. And we looked up their web address, and then we looked up who was registering their web address. And then on one occasion, we phoned the phone number on the web address after hours, and the phone was picked up by the person on the other end who announced the name of the PR company which ran this organisation. So in a kind of serendipitous thing like that, you're able to just to investigate the things which are on the public record and find out by calling the number that a PR firm is actually running this apparently scientific organisation.
Crikey! So that's an institute which is set up as supposedly a scientific, and you know, by which it sounds like it should be an unbiased organisation, but actually
that's right.
It's a sort of front public relations.
It's a front organisation.
One of the things that annoys me, David, I don't know if it annoys you quite as much, but it is the fact that many of these big corporations use public relations, and they use this whole area of putting money into PR the write-off against tax. So when they're looking at, oh, there's going to be a big tax bill, they can start spending extra in that budgetary year on public relations, on spin, on advertising, and then they find that they have to pay less tax at the end of the year.
Well, I mean, the funding is another thing which is possible to find out. I mean, many of these organisations, public relations organisations, lobbying organisations, supposedly scientific institutes or shadowy kind of think tanks, they are all funded by either directly by corporations or by large conservative foundations, either in the UK or in the US in many cases.
Conservative foundations. Now, yeah. Does that mean conservative with a big C, a small C?
I mean,
right wing.
Conservative with a small C, i.e., not Conservative Party, but you know, these are largely foundations set up by phenomenally rich individuals, mostly who've had long careers in business, so in the financial sector or in manufacturing. And they set up foundations to manage public debate and to manage public decision-making, so that's what all these think tanks, when you hear of a think tank on television or in the press, they are almost entirely, in this country and in the US, almost entirely funded by big business or by the conservative foundations.
Now, one of the things you mentioned at the start again was to do with the oil industry and the environment. Can you just drill into that a little bit and explain how that works? Because I think the whole debate about climate change, whether it's really happening, whether mankind is causing it, is a massively important area of public discourse. And policy is being set internationally based on what some of these institutes are coming up. So what have you found out about what the oil industry is up to there?
Well, I mean, I think it's a slightly complicated picture. I mean, the most simple end of it is that the climate sceptics, those people who say that climate change is not happening, or it's not there's nothing we can do about it, or it's not caused by human activities, all those kinds of ideas, those are all people who are funded by the oil industry, more or less, by Exxon or by the Koch brothers, phenomenally wealthy oil industry entrepreneurs in the States. And one should just simply discount everything they say. I know the BBC just the other day has been saying that they must take cognizance of the climate skeptics. Well, they have no basis in any science at all, and they should simply be ignored. But their cacophony, it does shape some elements of the media, and some people do believe the rubbish that they spout. But that's only one element, and that's not necessarily the most important element of corporate involvement in climate politics. Because the other element is the kind of liberal end of the oil industry, which says that it believes in sustainable development, which is a nice green sounding phrase, and it wants to improve carbon emissions and probably go towards renewable energy, and they form a whole series of of pressure groups, of lobby groups, and they argue that in order to deal with climate change, which they say is happening, we need simply to have market solutions. That is, we don't need to control the corporations. Now, in climate, as with tobacco and other similar issues, the solution is not to try and get people to smoke a little bit less or try and do some nice green things to make people feel better. The solution is to control the corporations, and that's the thing which nobody will say in the mainstream. You've got, you know, if you want to sort the world's problems out, you have to control the corporations.
All we hear about really seems to be deregulation right from the banks down.
You hear about deregulation, or you hear about corporate social responsibility, or corporations getting together to do the right thing, to self-regulate, and all these kind of ridiculous phrases, which don't mean anything, of course. They mean that the corporations will be allowed to go on plying tobacco or causing pollution. And in the case of climate change, you know, we move incrementally closer to the edge, and no one will say that actually this is not a solution. You have to actually control what the corporations do, particularly the ones that are engaged in extracting fossil fuels. Otherwise, there is no solution.
A little bit worrying. The other aspect, another aspect of one, I think it's a website too, if I'm right, is Powerbase, which doesn't just look at individual specific people and specific companies, but is starting to look at the wider networks of power. So how does that work?
Well, it's a wiki site like Wikipedia, so you have a page on each corporation or think tank or the directors of those corporations or think tanks, and it tries to show how they are connected to each other. To the extent that they are. I mean, people often think that, you know, there's a corporation which has a certain number of people working in it, and then there's a think tank, and that has maybe some corporate funding, but it's different people working in it. But actually, if you look at the elite of the corporations, the top 1,000 companies in the world, and you look at the big think tanks in any particular country, and then transnational groupings, then the people who are involved in all of those are the same people. They might be directors of 4 or 5 companies. They might also be meet with the directors. They meet in the corporate boards in these policy planning or think tank groups. These are people who are a well-networked corporate elite. And what we wanted to show with the wiki is the way in which those connections exist. It's not just a set of individuals in different companies and corporations. The biggest corporations are actually form a very strong and tight elite network, which is able to take decisions affecting thousands and millions of people's lives every day.
Now, with more and more privatisation, I mean, we were talking a little while about the health service. It seems that the role of government and the democratic aspects to our society is kind of dissolving. Where does that leave us? I mean, it seems to be taking us down the road where actually these big corporations you were just talking about really do have power. I mean, I imagine, you know, the sort of Bill Gates style characters, people that are super rich, they've got so much money, they've got their own private, you know, Spitfire plane to fly around in. They've got, you know, massive amounts of property in all sorts of parts of the world. And when they get to that stage, they start thinking to themselves, well, actually, what I really want is power. It looks to me as if they're starting to get that power as governments in the West are becoming less and less important as more and more of what they do is privatised.
I'm not sure that governments are becoming less important. I think that what has happened is that governments have been captured by the corporations rather than becoming less important. So that when you saw, since the Thatcher government in 79 to 90, and then from 97 with the Blair government and the Brown government, and now the current coalition, I mean, these are all governments who are fundamentally sympathetic towards the corporations, regardless of what they actually say. So that Call Me Dave Cameron will say nice things and say that we have to have transparency, but that's the function of those politicians, is to pretend that they care about popular or populist ideas while at the same time pushing through corporate interests. And that's what all governments in the West, especially the US and UK governments, who are way in advance of even right-wing governments in Germany, for example. I mean, those are governments who are there to push corporate aims. So it's not true, I think, to say that government's less important, although I think it's clearly the case that corporations now have the whip hand and can, you know, change elements of government policy at will sometimes. But there is a whole industry dedicated to making sure that government policy follows the interests of particular corporations. So I think there is some element of competition there between different industry sectors for pushing particular particular policy options. But in relation to health, I mean, I think you look at the way in which health policy has changed, particularly in England and Wales, not the same in Scotland, where I'm from, which is now where it's devolved and is not nearly as badly corrupted as it is in England and Wales now. And you can see, if you live in Scotland, or you can see visibly see the difference between the NHS in England and Wales and the NHS in Scotland. And the way in which that was put in place was by a network of individuals who are from the private healthcare industry, and then they populate lobby groups and think tanks, and they second themselves to Tony Blair's private office or to advisors to David Cameron, and they then move around. So people go from the think tank to the private healthcare industry to work in the Treasury, and so the people who are in the government making the decisions have in many occasions been actually in the private industry themselves. So they don't have any sense that there's a distinction between government and the private sector.
This is the revolving doors, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, we did some work three or four years ago, on the revolving door in relation to the financial industry, just after the financial crash. We did this in 2009. And we looked at the top 120-odd banks, who are the top banks and the top 1,000 companies in the world, and how many positions they had of directors who had also been involved either in government as government ministers or other roles or in regulatory bodies. And we found a huge revolving door problem in almost all of the banks.
Well, that starts to look, sorry to interrupt you, but it starts to look as if these people are in government, and whilst they're in government, they're being approached by private banks on the outside saying, well, you know, there may be a very nice little job for you when you finish government. Can you fix it for us?
I think it rarely happens as crudely as that, although probably we wouldn't know.
Maybe down the club, the club, you know, one of these London clubs or something.
The London clubs have been very important. I think they're less important now. The big policy planning groups, international policy planning groups, much more important, I think, now than the gentleman's class, which used to be more important. But yes, I mean, I think there's a nod and a wink, isn't there? And, you know, you've seen that in the various lobbying scandals that there have been. I don't know if you remember when Patricia Hewitt and Stephen Byers were filmed covertly, and Jeff Hoon, the ex-defence minister, and Byers talked about being a cab for hire, and these were ministers who were saying, well, you know, we've done our service in the democratic system, and now £5,000 a day for you, and I'll do what you want. And that, you know, there's a very much a sense amongst the political elite now that this is a career. It's not that they've come from a job as a teacher and they'll go back to that job. It's that they're now in a career, political career, when they expect to have, once they come out of Parliament, they expect to have very lucrative careers as business advisors. And that's fundamentally corrupt.
It is. I mean, on the way, so they're seeing really electoral politics as a part of their career on the way to the real career, which is at the top of industry, the top of business or finance. Is there any way to break that?
Yeah, it's called democracy, and it's a simple idea, but people vote, and that's what decides politics. But the ability of people to vote and therefore to make a difference to the society has been fundamentally undermined in the last 20 to 30 years, not by accident, but by a deliberate set of processes, but by the very people I've just been talking about, the think tanks, the corporations, and the people who are behind them.
Now, David, I went down to Frome a few weeks ago, maybe even a couple of months ago, to see a talk that you gave about Islamic terrorism. And one of the things you were doing there was to contrast the reality with what we see in the newspapers and on our TV screens. So can you just explain what the crux is of the difference between the two?
Well, I mean, I guess we have been interested in the whole question of Islam and Islamophobia and how that gets encouraged, and so we've been looking at the various ways in which that happens. And I think one of the strands of that is through the state and the information apparatus of government departments. And so we wanted to. Let me tell you the story about in the way it came about. I mean, I came across this report, someone online put it on Facebook or something. I don't know. From Europol, which is the European Policing Agency, which, as I'm sure your listeners will know, is an agency which is made up of contributions from all the European nations, and it gets its data and its funding from the governments of all the European countries. In this case now it's 27 of the European countries. And they produce this report every year on terrorism, and they compile the data from the Home Office in the UK and from the similar offices all across Europe. And they divide terrorism up into different kinds. They have nationalist terrorism and Islamic terrorism and animal rights extremism, etc. And they have this big table, and they show you how much there is. And one of the things I do in my talks is I ask people, I give them the full number of terrorist incidents in each of the years 2008 to 2010. It's around about 500 to 700 incidents every year across the whole of Europe. And I ask them what proportion, what percentage do they think is Islamic terrorism? And usually people say, 50%, 10%, sometimes they go down 2%. And never do they go to the real figure, which is in every single year, less than 1% of terrorist incidents are caused by people who would be described as Islamic terrorists. And people are usually quite surprised at that. As I hasten to emphasise to them, this is data from Europol, European Policing Agency, not from me. I didn't make this up. And you just compare that with the way in which terrorism is discussed in the press and the media. And of course, overwhelmingly, the single most covered kind of terrorism in the UK press is Islamic terrorism, followed some way down by terrorism in Northern Ireland. And we did have a slight problem with the data, because there was only one country who'd refused to break down terrorism into the different kinds of terrorism. So, and guess which one that was? It was the UK. And so we thought, how are we going to find out how many of the, I don't know how many it was, 50 or 60 incidents of terrorism in the UK for this particular year were caused by Islamic extremists and how many by others? And we thought, we'll ask the Home Office. They've supplied the data to Europol, so presumably they can tell us. So we asked them under the FOI and the Freedom of Information Act, and they said, don't be silly, we're not going to tell you that. So we thought, is there another way of doing it? So we thought, well, the police service in Northern Ireland usually has quite good data. So we FOI'd them, and I asked about terrorist incidents in Northern Ireland, and they came back with a huge slew of statistics about how many dogs had barked in West Belfast on a Saturday night. And we could tell from that overwhelmingly all the terrorism that happened in the UK was in relation to Northern Ireland, with one or two exceptions by Islamists, which are all examples we know about, the Glasgow airport bombing, etc. So what we were able to do, using official data, was to show that there was a systematic imbalance both in people's perceptions and in terms of government encouragement to believe that the single most important threat was Islamic terrorism, which statistically is not. So that was one way through of trying to shed a little bit of light on how things really are, and on the process by which, in particular, government tries to encourage hatred against Muslims. I'm particularly mentioning government as opposed to the press, and I can tell you why if you want.
Yes, well, I'm fascinated, because I would have thought that this is something which the press are deciding, not the government. Surely the press is saying, well, this is an important incident, we need to look at this, rather than the government deciding that.
No, it's the government. I mean, when one's finished talking about the evils of the sun, which I will join you with, or the Telegraph or the Mail, whatever, I'm quite happy to join you in discussing those things. But actually, these stories come from the government. And if you look at, in particular, individual cases, which we did, individual cases of terror threats, and where people were arrested, and it was said that there were plots to create ricin or to bomb Edinburgh or cross Channel Ferry or to gas the tube, any of those things which people might remember from years gone by. And when you looked at that in detail, this wasn't stuff which was made up by the press. It was stuff which had come from MI5 and from the police and from ministers. And so it's absolutely clear that behind all of that is a specific government intent to create the notion of an Islamic threat, which it doesn't really bear close inspection.
Fascinating. What about the link to these experts that we see? I've always been a little bit wary of, when they say a defence expert. I mean, we're starting to get, particularly since the 7/7 bombings in 2005, terrorism experts too. What have you found out about where they're coming from? Because that concerns me, where where maybe an expert gets their funding from.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just the second of what I would see as three main channels through which hatred of Muslims is encouraged, is through the use of expertise. Now, and that when we say terrorism experts, of course, we must be very careful what we mean by that, because in many cases, these people aren't experts. Three or four years ago, we did a study where we looked at the people who were the most highly cited in academic papers on terrorism. And we compiled a list of the most highly cited people, including everyone who'd ever written an article on terrorism ever in the history of the world, right? And actually, the first article on terrorism in the academic journals was from 1973. Anyhow, we compiled that data, and we then compared the list of the top 20 or 30 of those with the list of those who were most highly cited in the English language press throughout the world. And the two lists didn't overlap. So the ones who were regarded as being experts by academics were not the same people who were regarded as being experts by the media. And so that's already a problem. But then you look at in detail at the people who are regarded by the media as being experts, and many of them are just not experts. They've got no qualifications, no academic qualification to allow them to talk about terrorism, and many of them are simply charlatans. We've been involved with a number of those, in fact, in exposing several...
give us an example.
Well, there's a guy called Evan Coleman, for example, who has testified in various terrorism trials in the US and including in the UK, and he was one of the key he was the key expert for the prosecution, which sent a guy in Scotland down for an alleged terrorist attack. Several years later he was then released as a wrongful conviction, and he had put together a farrago of nonsense about this guy being connected to Al-Qaeda. He was a young student in Glasgow who had been really angered by Gaza and the attacks on Gaza, and had said some unwise things, but he was not a terrorist. And someone like Coleman was there, and it's been revealed in several terrorism cases and by the work that we did that he claimed to have a postgraduate degree. He didn't have one. He claimed to have his book published by Oxford University Press. It wasn't published by that. He claimed that his work was peer-reviewed. It's not been peer-reviewed. So a series of not quite accurate accounts of his expertise, but that's one example. But there are many examples like that of people who are simply charlatans. Now that's part of the problem. The other part of the problem is that the people who are most highly cited in the press, quite a number of them aren't charlatans. They're people who are in real academic jobs, but they tend also to have strong connections with the intelligence agencies or the police or the military, that they tend to say the kinds of things which the police, military and intelligence services want them to say. And so I would see those kinds of experts as being official experts who are in effect simply mouthpieces for government.
I remember also there was a Newsnight investigation, which I know there was some involvement with Spinwatch, about an organisation called Policy Exchange that said that, this is a couple of years ago, certain radical Islamic bookshops were selling books that actually they weren't, and they went to the trouble of actually falsifying receipts from those. Surely that is in some way inciting racial hatred, or there must be some sort of reason why people like that should never be able to practice again if they're actually falsifying evidence.
I mean, that's the third area of encouragement of Islamophobia is the think tanks, and the think tanks, of course, funded by conservative foundations, quite often with links to Israel, as in the case of Policy Exchange and the Centre for Social Cohesion, another one which we examined. Those think tanks are there to encourage the idea that there is an Islamic threat, that Muslims are trying to take over our country or outbreed us or some such rubbish. And yes, in that case, the Policy Exchange tried to show that mosques up and down the country were peddling what they called hate literature. But it was shown by the BBC that some of the receipts had been fabricated. Some of them had been written on top of others, which had allegedly been got from mosques miles apart. And the Policy Exchange threatened to sue the BBC, but a writ was not forthcoming, as they say in legal parlance, which means, of course, that they had to take the report down from their website. So those kinds of think tanks are very strongly involved in what they would see as political warfare, and they have a model of political warfare which is based on the Cold War, and so on combating the Soviet Union, and so they see Muslims and Islam as being the next big threat after communism, and that it has to be combated. It's not a question of being combated in relation to the threat posed by violence, but the threat they see is a threat of ideas, and therefore they want to encourage the idea that Islam is a threat, and that what that does in the end is encourages people like the English Defence League, I'm afraid.
What about health? Because at the moment there's a lot of people concerned about what's going on with the National Health Service, maybe around the world seen as one of the jewels in the crown of Britain, which is now the vultures are circling around looking at it, wondering, well, if we can actually crush this little National Health Service, people will have to come to us and hand over large amounts of their personal wealth in order to safeguard their health.
Well, it's not just the vultures are circling, they're already picking at the flesh. I mean, the corporations are already in there. And the process by which that happened, was a process in which think tanks and lobby groups were able to populate the information environment around elites and to convince them that there was a variety of views in favour of what they call reform of the health service. Everyone else calls, of course, privatisation, but they say it's not privatisation, it's simply reform. Of course, it is about bringing the corporations in and allowing people to make profits out of the health service, which of course mean that the free at the point of use health service that we knew will be, already is, gone in England and Wales. That's an ongoing process which has been accomplished by private healthcare companies, by the think tanks that they employ and the lobby groups associated with them, and also by their capture of politicians and policymakers, in particular from the past Labour government, but also from the current coalition cabinet, many of whom have got personal financial interests in the health service, in healthcare companies, sorry.
You were talking about political warfare earlier on. How does the public fight back against something like that in order to preserve what actually means, passing down something very, very valuable to future generations?
Well, it's very difficult. I mean, I think that we are in a position now where the bulk of the population in this country is very, very sceptical about almost every political institution in this country, about the politicians, House of Lords, the MPs, the ministers. They're sceptical about the media after Leveson. They're sceptical about the police after Leveson and Hillsborough. They're sceptical of almost every political institution, including, of course, the bankers. How could I forget the bankers? What happens as a result of that? We've had several inquiries in the last few years, including what appear to be quite good inquiries on the press, on Bloody Sunday, on Hillsborough, but we don't seem to have, as a society, any ability to do anything as a result. After the Lords' lobbying scandal and the expenses scandal, virtually nothing happened. There's been no proper reform of any of that in terms of transparency or ethics. And so we're in a society where everybody knows that the society is deeply, deeply corrupt, but that there's no ability to do anything because the system of democracy has kind of curdled into something which doesn't function anymore, and that's been done deliberately by the corporations because they don't want it to function, and so that's a difficulty. I think the only way forward to answer the question is for us to recreate the institutions of democracy, and there are many ways to do that. That can be done at community organisation level, or it can be done at a higher level of a popular struggle to bring in democratic reforms. And if we remember, democratic reforms have only been here in the last 100 years or so, and with the winning of the vote, and then the winning of vote for women. That's less than 100 years that we've had the possibility of some kind of democratic process. But those reforms themselves took hundreds of years, took decades to fight for and to win. And I'm afraid that's what we face, a decades-long struggle to try and create a society where some measure of democracy can function.
And thanks to Bristol Broadband Cooperative for that, which was broadcast on the 9th of July, 2013. I'm a fan, by the way, of the Spinwatch website, and some of the research for this show and other shows comes when I browse Wikipedia. Then Wikipedia Plus software pops up a link to the appropriate Spinwatch page. That's often got, for my purposes, more enlightening information than is available on Wikipedia. Well, any treatment of Islamophobia in the UK would have to include something about July the 7th, 2005, when the bombs went off in London. So let's hear now a concluding minute or so of a BBC recording from the day itself.
This clearly was a callous attack on purely innocent members of the public, deliberately designed to kill and injure innocent members of the public.
The government said tonight this had all the hallmarks of an Al-Qaeda attack: organisation, coordination and ruthlessness.
This, I'll just interrupt to point out, is not interviews, these are prepared statements. So people had time to work out what messages they wanted to get across. So don't repeat innocent members of the public unless you want to emphasise it. If Al-Qaeda's hallmarks are coordination, organisation and ruthlessness, then I, for one, can think of a great number of actions carried out. For example, I thought by the business community or by UK and US military leaders, which have all three of those hallmarks. So to clarify, this is not a logical argument. These are emotional appeals. These are statements which have been worked out by people. Bearing in mind Naomi Klein's idea of the shock doctrine, people are in shock. Shocking things have happened. This is the time at which you can address these people. If you're a government, you speak to them as a parent speaks to a child. These are not rational arguments. Let's hear what Tony Blair's spin masters had to say, bearing in mind this is on the same day of the attacks.
We know that these people act in the name of Islam. But we also know that the vast and overwhelming majority of Muslims here and abroad are decent and law-abiding people who abhor this act of terrorism every bit as much as we do.
Well, I find it revealing that Tony Blair is so quick to pin the blame on Islamic militants. Reminds me slightly of how quick the US government was to pin the blame on Osama bin Laden for September the 11th, who later denied it. Of course, if you blame it on a religion, there's nobody officially to deny it. And the culprits, if the government's suicide bomber theory is to be believed, no longer available, which could have made for a fairly tidy story, except there seemed to be a few loose ends flapping around. Tony Blair promised everybody that all the information the government had on this would be released to them, which seems to be extremely far from the truth. It is interesting that whilst train accidents routinely investigated in Britain, the Blair government decided the 7/7 bombings didn't merit a public inquiry. That would, quote, prejudice the current investigation, unquote. He said it would, quote, prevent the police and government from focusing on future attacks, unquote. I presume he meant focusing on preventing future attacks rather than carrying them out. He said it would take, quote, too much time, cost too much money, and divert resources away from the war on terrorism, unquote. So, much better to save your money for a proper war, rather than work out what's actually happened. 4 days later, Tony Blair famously said that a public inquiry would be, quote, a ludicrous diversion, unquote. Much better, he said, to sharpen up the anti-terror laws scheduled for next year and fast-track them in. Does this sound familiar? I think if you're aware of the Patriot Act, you'll see a parallel here. And that's what really aroused me to suspect the truth of 7/7 may be something very different from what the government says it was. It's the extended parallels with 9/11. But to get back to what Tony Blair said on the day, having pointed the finger of suspicion very clearly at fanatical Muslims, in fact saying he knew that it was done in the name of Allah, without bothering to present any evidence, he then goes on, as if he's trying to promote racial harmony, to remind us that the vast majority of Muslims would never do such a thing, and they don't support terrorism. Well, the fact that he bothered to point that out rather suggests that Muslims are a shady lot, the way that I hear it. I remember as a child listening to reports of bombings in Northern Ireland where the BBC seemed to be quite determined to point out the number of Catholic casualties and the number of Protestant casualties as if they were two separate species. And, I mean, I asked my mum and said, you know, why do they do that? The thought didn't cross my mind as a youngster that it might be a deliberate policy to incite strife, because in those days I trusted the BBC as the good guys. But the more I learn, the more it seems to me that these are hired guns. Because it's a commercial organisation, whatever tenuous claims to public servanthood, it's operating in the marketplace. People can be bought and sold, and people can be put through the mill if they don't follow their orders. So it's a hierarchy, and it's more or less commercially controlled. And has anything changed since the days of the 1970s? Well, I recorded this about 3 days ago. This is from an Australian report about some people who were picked up in London.
Police move in and tackle the men to the ground, bystanders clearly shocked by the commotion. It's one of three raids across London on Sunday night. Four men arrested on suspicion they were planning an attack similar to the shooting spree that killed 67 people at Kenya's Westgate Mall. In another raid, police fired at a car near the Tower of London, arresting two 25-year-old men. Another suspect was arrested in southeast London. Police say the suspects are all aged in their 20s, with roots in Turkey, Pakistan, Algeria and Azerbaijan.
That's an interesting turn of phrase, isn't it? With roots in. Do you think if these people had had roots in Essex, Southampton, Northumberland and Wales, the newscaster would have bothered to report it? I mean, just as Howard Zinn pointed out to me, the selective information that we're given in history textbooks is more deceitful and harder to detect than a straight-out lie would be. Similarly, the decision about what stories to report and how to report them has a very powerful effect in shaping people's consciousness, and one that I think it behoves us as world citizens of the 21st century to do our own personal bests to be aware of and to correct for if we don't like the idea of demonizing one religion or one nation, or if we consider these are pretty arbitrary distinctions, then let's make a conscious effort to notice when other people report things in such a way to try and divide us. Now, the next piece is the soundtrack of On the Edge Media, a discussion which we heard a little snippet of introducing the show with Tony Farrell, whom we've had once on the show before, Ian Puddick, who's experienced the sharp end of the privatised police force, these days seeming more like corporate servants than servants of the innocent members of the public, and host Brian Gerrish. And this is from 2012.
Good evening and welcome back to On the Edge. And I'm very pleased to welcome Ian Puddick into the studio. We're talking about the serious subject of intelligence and the threat to UK and how that threat's formulated. And in particular with Tony, I know you know each other well. We're looking at how the police are dealing with this. So we've got part of the subject still to do, and then we'll come on to your experiences of,
sure,
of police forces in Britain. But over the break, we've had some good, very good emails in, and I'm going to say there's a whole wedge of them which are asking one question, and that is, what do we think about the privatisation of the police and corporatisation of the police force? And I'm just going to moment focus here with Tony, but what's your view on that?
I think that you've got issues with neighbourhood policing. Police have got budget cuts for 20% at the moment, and that's right across 43 police forces in England and Wales. And then you've got the other arm, how do we deal with the protective services, the serious crime that is perhaps too complex to deal with for most small police forces. And increasingly we are seeing, at the lower end for instance, different ways of policing on the side, which if it can be done more efficiently, there is some merit in that. However, at the higher end, you've got to, we've got to question what is the role of the police, who are they accountable to, and the function of the police. And increasingly, we're seeing that the police decision-making processes could be led by more by finance than actually being proper public servants.
So we've got the finance issue. We've also got accountability, because the police forces should be, and I believe still are to a large extent, accountable. We could debate part of that, and I'm sure Ian would like to jump on that. But now we're bringing in corporations, and we're saying, well, who are they accountable to, and who are those people? Now, if I can just ask if we can bring on slide 110. This is part of a UK column article which we published a little while ago, and the article was about essentially MI5 being switched off in 1998. The Sunday Times did quite a big article saying that basically MI5 wasn't going to be used to look at internal threats of subversives or agitators within the country. Files were going to be destroyed. Jack Straw was one of the leading men behind this. So we watched with interest as key part of our intelligence services were being shut down on looking at a domestic threat. Mm-hmm. And the people who were shutting them down were people who MI5 had been looking at originally. It sounds a bit like phone hacking to me. If the press looks at you too closely, you shut it down. So this was quite a key thing for me, because I say to myself, you know, with a security type hat on, my former life, if you shut down MI5, who's going to do the job? And one of the things that I know, and we were chatting about before the show started, was that you are now seeing that universities are being brought into the picture to analyse intelligence and threat data. Could you tell us a bit more about that and what you feel?
Just so I want to be a little bit clear about MI5. What the government did do before the London bombings was immediately drop the terror threat down. So they gave an impression that we haven't got quite as much to fear as we normally would, and then lo and behold, we have a terror threat that actually reverses what they were saying.
Right.
And injects the result, you know, post 7/7, we have an injection and a strengthening of MI5 resources. But we are increasingly seeing universities get involved in programs, for instance, on counterterrorism, within the rich picture, whereby educational programs are being permeated throughout the community in order to articulate a particular narrative, normally a narrative that sits squarely with what the government would want us to believe.
So we've got universities who are overwhelmingly helped in their funding by the government.
Yeah.
And they are now being used in order to build an intelligence picture. Mm-hmm. This could be a little bit like maybe global warming, where we've got universities deciding what information the public needs to know, because that affects their balance sheet. Yeah. And this is quite a dangerous situation, isn't it? I think this is the point, just to bring in Ian, and I'll just let you very quickly just tell us how you came to be here. Don't get into too much detail, because I want to pull some things out.
Sure.
Okay, but
sure.
For viewers who don't know you,
in essence,
why are you here?
In essence, I was charged with creating a website, which I obviously did create, called policeexpenses.co.uk, and the police were very unhappy with that website.
Yeah.
And they used the counter-terrorism directorate to raid my home, to raid my office, to raid my accountant's office, a major, major operation, basically to close me down, to find any sort of criminality within my life.
Right, just tell us how big an operation.
Well, it's
two key pieces of information.
Well,
isn't
one
it?
It's called Operation Bohan. You won't get much information on it because they try and censor it, and it cost over £1 million to censor a website. The judge in court, obviously, when I went to court, said that what I'd said was true, and obviously I had a right to say it.
Yeah. £1 million, and how many officers active on the ground?
Well, on the day of the first big raid, in excess of 20 officers. But prior to that, in terms of following me around and all the rest of it, how much time? I mean, every freedom of information request has been declined on the grounds that it would cost too much to investigate and see how much the cost was.
Yeah.
Right, which is quite incredible. So
yeah.
So we've got Tony here as a senior analyst who's looking at terrorist threats and threats to this country, and he speaks up for what he believes to be correct,
sure.
And he's now out of a job. And we've got yourself who's challenged the system, and suddenly £1 million can be spent on the streets.
Yeah, without question.
And that was brought out in the court case. And
sure.
Obviously people can go to your website and actually have a look at your story.
Been debated in Parliament.
Yeah.